From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Haley Qualls, a journalism student at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, currently doing an internship in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. Our topic on this edition of the program, George Floyd, a man whose death inspired a movement of change regarding racial inequality in the United States and the rest of the world. Our guest, Tolu Olorunipa, co-author of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and Struggle for Racial Justice. The book's other author, Robert Samuels, was unable to join us today. The book is more than a biography of George Floyd. It documents how racism adversely affected George Floyd's life and death and made an indelible impact on society, covering everything from his family's heritage as slaves and sharecroppers to his childhood to his shocking death by the police brutality that shaped a movement. The book embodies George Floyd's full legacy. His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and Struggle for Racial Justice exemplifies the ongoing problem of inequality and systemic racism in every aspect of life in America, including in education, criminal justice, and health care. Olorunipa and Samuels interviewed hundreds of Floyd's closest friends and family, his elementary school teachers, athletic coaches, civil rights activists, and political leaders to paint a fuller portrait of George Floyd, whose name has heretofore been associated with his brutal, premature death. Published only in May 2022, the biography has already received rave reviews. The New York Times Book Review said, quote, "It is a testament to the power of His Name is George Floyd that the book's most vital moments come not after Floyd's death, but in its intimate, unvarnished, and scrupulous account of his life," unquote. Co-author Tolu Olorunipa has been a political enterprise and investigations reporter for The Washington Post since 2019. He has also covered the White House for The Post. Prior to joining the paper, Tolu spent several years at Bloomberg News, where he reported on politics and policy from Washington and Florida. He is an on-air contributor for CNN. And Tolu Olorunipa joins us via Microsoft Teams. Tolu, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol. And it's really great to be with you. Thanks for those kind words about the book.
Well, we're delighted to have you. And Haley Qualls, welcome also to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tolu Olorunipa, congratulations on this extraordinary biography, which I read from front to back. It's really a tour de force.
Thank you so much. We really wanted people to come away with an understanding of George Floyd's life, his humanity, but also America, the country that has had highs and lows in its history. And those highs and lows were experienced in George Floyd's life, especially when it comes to race. And that's what we wanted to do in the book. And I'm really glad you were able to get what we wanted to put into it.
And Tolu, you know, given our large Nigerian audience, I would be remiss not to emphasize your Nigerian roots. Your name in Yoruba means God is powerful. So know that you are speaking to many of your Nigerian brethren who are big fans, I'm proud to say, of our program.
Yes, I'm really excited to be on your program for that and for other reasons. And my Nigerian background is incredibly important to me. Both my parents were born in Nigeria and I've been back several times. All of my cousins and extended family are over there. I got married there. It's a place that is a very important part of my heritage, a very important part of my understanding. And some of that comes across in the book and sort of understanding the difference. My American experience has been different from George Floyd's experience. My parents came here voluntarily, didn't have that legacy of slavery and that history. George Floyd had that in his family, and it's a clear understanding of how much that can have an impact on someone. So it was important for me to grapple with my own background as I was writing this book and maybe make some comparisons with George Floyd's background and see how our paths diverged and see how there are some similarities in our experience as well. So, you know, as journalists, we try to be unbiased, but we all bring our own history and our own background. And my Nigerian background was incredibly important to me. It's something I'm very proud of, and it's something that makes me very excited to be talking to you, because I know your audience is full of people who hail from Nigeria and come from that rich country where there's so much culture. I hope Nigerian audiences take the opportunity to read the book as well, because I think there's a lot that you can learn about America, a lot that you can learn about George Floyd and the global movement that was sparked by his death by reading this book.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and we'll get into those details. But let me first ask you what prompted you and Robert Samuels to team up and write this book now, approximately 2 years after Floyd's murder, under the knee of a white Minneapolis police officer.
Robert and I saw what happened to George Floyd, like millions of other people around the world, and we were shocked by it, like everyone else. And we saw the movement that was sparked by his murder, and we realized that something was changing, something different was happening. His murder sparked an emotion in so many people that caused them to leave their homes in the middle of a pandemic and take to the streets and protest. And we knew that there was more to his story than that 9-minute, 29-second video of him dying. And we realized we didn't know very much about him as a person. We knew about the movement that he had sparked. We knew about his death. We didn't know very much about his life. So we, along with several other reporters at the Washington Post, decided to take some time to delve into his life and to look at his life through the lens of systemic racism, because we knew that he died because of a kind of systemic racism that we see in police brutality. But also, as he lived, he experienced systemic racism. And we wanted to be able to show through his life how that operates in the 21st century. So we looked at his experience in the government housing projects. We looked at his experience in the public school system that was segregated. We looked at his experience in the criminal justice system, which has all kinds of racial disparities. And we looked at his experiences with health issues and healthcare, which also suffers from discrimination and racial disparities. And so along with our colleagues, we put together this 6-part series in the Post, and we were able to go deeper on his life than any other journalist or any other team. And we thought, even after doing that, there was still more to the story. Robert and I decided to move beyond the series and turn what we had learned and what we would learn over the course of a year into a book-length project that we thought would have the ability to let people know that George Floyd was a human being. He was not just a protest symbol. He was someone with flaws, someone with all kinds of great parts about his character. He had people who loved him. He loved people. And we wanted to reflect his humanity as well as reflect what his death and what his murder showcased about the world we live in, about the America that he lived in and the America that he died in as well.
Well, all of that comes through loud and clear in your beautifully written book. But let me turn to Haley Qualls for a question for you. Haley.
Thanks, Carol. Toloop, let me first say the book was above and beyond. Really resonated with me hearing his bringing up story. You mentioned it inspired such a movement of people leaving their houses in such a difficult time during COVID-19. Why do you think it made the public response to George Floyd's death so different to inspire the Black Lives Matter movement?
That's a great question, Haley. I have grappled with that question myself as we were writing this book. And I think part of it had to do with the world that we were living in the spring of 2020. The COVID-19 pandemic was still raging and hundreds of people were dying in America every day, thousands of people around the world. And for that reason, a lot of people were at home. They weren't going to sports games or concerts or other things that would maybe be diversion from the news on the television. And the news on the television was the death of a Black man under the knee of a white police officer. And it wasn't one of those videos that happens in a split second where you're not really sure what happened. This was 9.5 excruciating minutes of death and torture that we all saw and we all could not look away from. And George Floyd, as he was dying, was calling out for his mother. He was pleading for his life. And we saw how the police officer did not heed his calls for mercy. And I think there's something universal about that human struggle to breathe, a human struggle to live, that people, you know, from different backgrounds, from different countries all around the world connected with. And that's part of the reason why it led to this broad global movement. It was symbolic that the agent of the state was effectively snuffing out the life of a human being who was suffering under the knee of that agent of the state. And it really struck home with a lot of people that that is the kind of oppression that we should all fight against. That's the kind of oppression that we shouldn't allow to happen. And because we were in a pandemic, because people were fed up with a lot of things happening, people just had reached their boiling point and they spilled out into the streets and said that this cannot be the country that we live in and things had to change. And it really became this domino effect where people across the world realized that they also are suffering under different forms of oppression, whether it's governmental oppression or otherwise, and discrimination and racism should have no place in the world. And I think that's why that galvanized so many people to speak up and say that in George Floyd's name, we have to stamp out racial injustice across the world.
Thank you. And in light of that and how that inspired such a movement, are you concerned at all that the outrage of George Floyd's murder will not continue as we continue to see even more incidents of excessive violence towards African Americans in this country, such as the recent murder of Jaylen Walker?
Yeah, that's another great question. In the book, we grappled with that because the timeline of this book extends beyond George Floyd's life and death into the aftermath and also into the backlash to the aftermath. We have seen not only a fading of the optimism and a fading of the energy of the movement, but also a backlash, people saying we shouldn't be talking about race. We shouldn't be reading about race in America. There's too much focus on this. It's this sort of right-wing backlash to the idea that racial injustice exists. And this concerning, and it's one of the reasons we wrote this book, was so that people would learn from our past and not try to dismiss it, not try to ignore it, not to ban books so we can't understand the past. And so it is a little concerning that not only has the energy faded, but also there's this backlash that sometimes is based on falsehoods, based on the idea that any discussion of race is a form of reverse racism or is a form of discrimination against white people. We don't espouse that in the book, and we make great efforts in the book to showcase that we believe that it's important for us to learn from our history. It's important for us to showcase the great parts of American history and also the parts of the American history that are not flattering and the parts that showcase the discrimination that were a part of American history. And by grappling with all of that, we can create a better future. We can continue to strive towards better angels of our nature, towards that more perfect union that we talk about in the founding documents of the American society. And it's important for us as journalists to continue to push for that, to use our First Amendment rights to make sure people are informed. And it is a little concerning that sometimes when there's this backlash and this flood of misinformation around race, it makes it much harder for people to be informed about history and about what's happening currently as well.
Thank you. I agree, Tolu. It's very important to educate people, especially young people, on our history. And on that note, back to you, Carol.
Thanks, Haley. And I'm going to pick up on that history point right after a short break. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. My guest is Tolu Olorunipa, co-author of the new book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is Haley Qualls, a journalism student at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. She's currently doing an internship in VOA's Current Affairs Programming Unit. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website. You may download it at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol_Castiel. Or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Ibrahim Ismailia. He's from the city of Zaria in the great nation of Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Tolu Olorunipa, the author of the new book, His Name is George Floyd. And Tolu, when we stopped for the break, you and Haley were talking about the historical context. And I think that's very important to emphasize. And I was myself extremely impressed by the way you wove historical facts into the book, providing context for Floyd's portrait, beginning with his great-great-great-grandfather, who was a slave in North Carolina. And then after emancipation, he thrived to some extent with property and farmland, but this was short-lived during Reconstruction. He fell back into poverty, lost land, doing sharecropping. Why, in your view, was it so important to document this historical context for the reader to get a better understanding of George Floyd's family history?
Yeah. Yes, and that was a really great breakdown of, you know, more than 200 years of history of George Floyd's family. And we wanted to make sure that we told his story as an American story, because his family's history goes back to around the founding of America. His family had worked hard in America for centuries, and he was still born poor. And we wanted to get to the bottom of why someone who came from a proud, hardworking family was still born poor. And there's no way to explain that without explaining how racism operates when it comes to generational wealth. George Floyd's great-great-grandfather had worked hard. He was born enslaved, but he received his freedom at the age of 8, and he worked hard over 30 years with a large family working the land and was able to amass 500 acres of land, making him pretty wealthy in the late 1800s. But because of racism, because of the way things operated at that period after Reconstruction, he had all of that land taken away from him, as millions of other people did around this time when black farmers had a brief period of wealth and land ownership, and slowly they had that wealth taken away through tax fraud, business fraud, essentially because they had no political power, they had no legal power, they couldn't even vote because they couldn't read at the time. They couldn't read because it had been outlawed for them to learn how to read. And so George Floyd's great-great-grandfather lost his chance at the American dream and died poor and was unable to pass anything down to his descendants. And so we wanted to show that despite working hard for more than 200 years, George Floyd's ancestors were not able to give him the benefits of that hard work. Instead, because of racism, the benefits of that hard work went to tobacco companies and university endowments and white landowners who were able to pass down wealth to their descendants and were able to build up an American dream that George Floyd never had access to. So it was important to show the racism that impacted George Floyd started long before he was born. And even as people like to say, you know, slavery was such a long time ago, all over the world, it can be hard for people to understand the grip of slavery and the grip of discrimination in American history. Today, we wanted to really showcase how those things reverberate across generations, and something that happened 100 years ago, 50 years ago, still has an impact, because in America, one way that you build wealth is through generational wealth transfers. You pass down your wealth to your descendants, and they're able to start with a fresh start. And that is something that George Floyd never had access to, despite the fact that his family had worked hard. They worked as sharecroppers, meaning they were working on farms owned by other people, and they were never able to really build any wealth for themselves. And it was really important for us to show that discrimination from the past impacted George Floyd's present and continued into the future, and showcasing how hard work did not translate into wealth. If he had had access to the wealth that his forebears had worked for, he might have came into the world with all of the trappings of that wealth, with the great education, with the great housing, with the great health care, and maybe he would have been able to pursue his dreams more easily instead of having to strive and struggle as he did and as his family did for several years before he died.
And Tolu, just to follow up on that, even after, for example, the sharecropping, and we have, particularly in the South, Jim Crow laws, separate facilities and institutions, education, etc., for blacks. And this separate but equal is really a misnomer. It was separate, but these institutions were not equal. And we know that that concept was struck down in the Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. But I wanted you to just briefly touch on the South and how much more pronounced racism was, and how much more difficult it was, in fact, for George Floyd and his family to overcome these barriers in schools, failing and impoverished schools that could never really compete. And then he went into sports. Athletics was far more stressed than academics for a lot of these mostly black schools. So really, there were so many structural barriers, which isn't to, in a way, excuse somebody for not being able to overcome them, but they were huge barriers for him and other blacks similarly situated.
Totally. And George Floyd was born in North Carolina in the South. He moved to Texas, another state in the South, when he was a boy. And those are both states in a part of the country where racism and discrimination are much more blatant. They had segregation that they felt was fine. They felt that separate was an okay way to run their society. And they pushed for that even after, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court ruled that we should have integration, or should not have segregation in schools, even up until the 1970s. Houston, where George Floyd grew up, was segregated in its school system. And not only was it separate, but it was very much unequal. And the places where George Floyd went to school were underfunded. They were dilapidated. They were all black schools where you did not have the funding and the resources that you would need to teach people and to allow them to reach their dreams. So we talked to George Floyd's second grade teacher. And at the time, he wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. He had these great dreams of being able to make it to the highest court in the land and being successful in the law and the legal sphere. But we saw over the course of his academic career, he wasn't able to reach those dreams, in part because he did not have the schooling, the academic resources to be able to soar and do very well, because he was attending schools that were plagued by underinvestment and plagued by lack of resources. And at the time, he was growing into a stronger and taller young man. And people said, if you wanted to make it out of your community, if you wanted to be successful, you might not be able to do it through school and academics, because there's not a lot of opportunity there. But you may be able to do it through athletics, through the sheer force of your athletic skills, you may be able to transcend your community and make it out and make a living for yourself. And he bought into that. He put his efforts and his attention into athletics, and he was actually fairly good. He made it to the state championship as a high school football player. But unfortunately, that focus on athletics left him unable to make his academic requirements when he got to college. And we saw that he ended up having to drop out of college because he was not academically eligible to play sports. And he saw that his family was struggling. He saw himself as the breadwinner for the family, and it seemed like his athletic dreams were not going to be realized. So he ended up going back to his community without a college degree, without a sports contract, and without a job or an income. And that led him to a situation where he ended up making some tough choices about how to try to provide for his family. And that led him into the criminal justice system, which we document very clearly in the book, how that criminal justice system had a disproportionate impact on George Floyd and on his community because of the way policing was done, because of the way discrimination had seeped into the criminal justice system in America. And he was right there at the same time when the war on drugs, the mass incarceration, and the American justice system were really gearing up. And he found himself caught in the crosshairs of that. And we document in the book how much time he ended up spending behind bars and how that limited his prospects and limited his ability to find a job and to live a normal life. Once he was branded a felon, it made it much harder for him to live a normal life and chase the opportunities and dreams that he continued to have later in life.
Absolutely. You really documented that very well. Let me now turn to Haley. She has another question for you.
Thanks, Carol. Tolu, as you said before, racism does have a historical presence in this country, but now it's kind of taking on a different platform. To what extent do you think social media is fueling racial hate, particularly as it relates to different theories such as white replacement?
Yeah, that's another really great question in terms of racism has a long history, and it seems to adapt to new technologies as they come into play. When television and motion pictures came into play, we saw films like Birth of a Nation used to put forward racial hatred. And now we have the internet, people being able to post things anonymously, to join up and connect with people in different places that may have similar views. So now some of the racist views that would have been put on the fringes in the past, people are able to connect with other people who have similar views, even if they're in different parts of the country or different parts of the world. And we are seeing some of those racist views be pushed forward on the internet. We're seeing people connect and find a home for their racism in ways that we may have not seen in the past. Now that the public square has gone online, we are seeing things like great replacement theory and other racist views being able to proliferate in ways that make it very dangerous for people who are the targets of that racial hatred.
So Tolu, back to George Floyd as the man and as an emblem of the story of Black Americans and Black men. He also, as you documented in the book, suffered from claustrophobia. He had some addiction problems. And there's, of course, this unfortunate trend in this country, particularly with respect to criminalization of Black men, rather than treating them for these underlying problems, they are incarcerated. And so talk about some of these problems that afflicted him, claustrophobia and his fear of police, because he had already been incarcerated up into the point when he was so mercilessly dealt with at Cup Foods in Minneapolis and was asphyxiated.
One of the things we wanted to do in writing this book was answer the question, why was George Floyd so terrified as soon as the police officer walked up to him when he was arrested on May 25th, 2020? We saw that look on his face. We saw how scared he looked. And one of the things we were able to learn was that he had had so many run-ins with the police, and he was incredibly terrified of encountering any police officer. He was terrified of going to jail again. He had had such a heinous experience in the criminal justice system that he was just terrified that he would have another experience like that. And that goes to the understanding of how race plays into criminal justice in this country, how it plays into addiction, how it plays into healthcare. George Floyd had a substance use issue. He had an addiction issue, and he had actually left Houston to move to Minneapolis to get treatment for that issue. But while he was in Texas and while he was in Minneapolis, he was criminalized because of that issue, as opposed to being given treatment. And one of the things we document is that when addiction was an issue in African-American communities, it was responded to by the government and by the police forces with harsh punitive responses when it became an issue in suburbia, in white communities, with opioid crises and other kinds of addiction issues. There was much more care given to the response. People said, we need to get people into treatment. We need to make sure people are able to get the right care so that addiction, which is a sickness and an illness, is treated in the right way, not only with jail time. And so we do see that disparate approach to similar issues in different communities, and George Floyd's life really exemplified that. And that's one of the reasons he was so terrified, is because he never felt that he would get a fair shake from law enforcement. He knew that he was a big black man, and that would come with certain stereotypes, that people would look at him and they would be intimidated. They would not want to give him the benefit of the doubt. They would not want to trust him. They would not want to allow him to breathe and have a shot, think of him as someone who was menacing and someone who would potentially be a threat, when he did not see himself that way. So it was important for us to document that and show how race played into that part of his life, that part of his experience, that part of the expression on his face when he was encountering those officers, and why he was so afraid to go into the police car. And it was important for us to show that that look and that response came from somewhere. It came from years and years of experiences with police that were often abusive, that were often exploitative, and that left him with these emotional and mental scars, in addition to claustrophobia, that are some of the scars and physical ailments that come along with having these really tough experiences with police when you're black in America. So that was important for us to document in the book as well.
Following up on that, looking to the future ramifications, as Haley has indicated, it seems that we're still seeing too many incidents of excessive violence by police targeting black men, young black men in particular. How optimistic or pessimistic are you about any kind of reform in the criminal justice system? Because so far, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act has not been able to be passed into law. That was one effort that many in Congress wanted very much to achieve. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things Robert and I wanted to do was to speak with the Reverend Jesse Jackson. And we talked to him about these issues. We talked to him about the long arc of the moral justice movement. And he was very optimistic, despite the fact that the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act had not been passed, despite the fact that there was this backlash. He looked at it in a broader way, and he said, look at what has happened both on the local level, in the local politics. We now have more black Americans that are running cities as mayors and more representation. We have a number of cities and a number of local communities that have pushed for police reform and pushed for racial justice in their policies. And there are a number of things happening in big and small ways across the country that shows that George Floyd's death did spark major changes. Now, it did not lead to the massive civil rights movement that some people expected when we saw the size of the protests and the number of people who came out. But there have been changes, and there have been things that have happened, from different communities banning the kinds of chokeholds that were used on George Floyd to no-knock warrants being banned from different police departments. And so those kinds of changes do breed some optimism that things can change and the movement can be more successful going forward. But there also is some sense of trepidation that even after everyone saw a man lose his life under the knee of a police officer, that was not enough to lead to a massive civil rights bill in the U.S. Congress, like the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, that the talks around that broke down, just like every other major issue seems to break down in Congress because of polarization and partisanship. So there is some level of angst about that. But, you know, having written this book and hoping that people engage with the book and are able to take some of the lessons away from the book and have some of that energy that we saw in the summer of 2020 in the protests, and with people realizing that we need to engage with our history, that we need to grapple with it, that we need to make changes in order to make the country a more fair and just place. We do hope that, as journalists, Robert and I, we do hope we're doing our part in making sure that people are educated and that they're aware of the life of someone like George Floyd and how his life showcases the need for change, the need for, you know, us to think about how to be more just and more fair and to eliminate, get rid of the kind of systemic racism that he experienced. And we do hope that the first step that people will take on that is educating themselves and becoming more aware. And we hope that this book does a little part in helping people to reach that level of awareness and understanding that we're all working to get to. there are parts of this book that are just about who he was as a person, that are filled with laughter, filled with joy, filled with love, just as he tried to navigate and trace his dreams. So we want people to read the book in part because even though it touches on some heavy subjects, it's also, you know, filled with lighthearted moments that allow us to understand that George Floyd was a human being and had human emotions and human experiences just like everyone else. And that's something I want people to take away as well.
The book is His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. The co-author, Tolu Olorunipa. Tolu, thank you once again for joining us, for writing this extremely important and timely book. We greatly appreciate your insights.
Thank you so much, Carol. And thank you, Haley. Your questions have all been really great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tolu. It was an honor talking to you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington by Haley Qualls. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for his technical assistance. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.